My name's Peter Haney. After finding a pretty smooth river rock near my grandmother's house, I took it to my kindergarten class for show and tell. Other than its beauty, I had little to say about it, but I liked it and it was a thing to show. At school, Steve Wasner told me that I had found a wishing rock. I could wish for anything and the rock would make it happen. I was excited about this and immediately wished for a treasure chest full of gold and jewels. I also shared the wishing rock with most of the other kids in the class. I had already spent hours poring over the glossy color inserts on precious and semi-precious stones in my parents' encyclopedia set, so when my classmates didn't know what to wish for, I had suggestions. I pushed the semi-precious stones because they seemed to have more going on than boring diamonds and rubies. Before long, most of us were set to own fantastic caches of beautiful gems. I'm not sure why I thought the treasure would be waiting for me at home. Why wouldn't it just appear? But when the school bus dropped me off, I ran inside and asked my mom where the chest was. She had no idea, and I was genuinely surprised. When I realized that Steve Wasner had made the whole thing up, I wasn't mad at him, but I worried that everyone would be mad at me the next day. They weren't, though. When I apologized to them for leading them to expect riches, they seemed nonplussed. Maybe I was the only person who took the whole thing seriously, or maybe the kids thought that wishing, not getting, was the point. Some probably made their wishes and then forgot about them. Steve Wasner never explained himself to me, and I never asked him for an explanation. So, you might be wondering what this has to do with spiritual growth, and I'm not sure myself. I'm more religious than spiritual. But for me, the experience was the first of many during childhood in which I genuinely and enthusiastically entertained the possibility of magic, and specifically the idea that there was some direct bridge between my desires and my mental state and the natural order around me. Each time I found the bridge just wasn't there. Lots of people must have had experiences like this, but even so, the wish it and it will be so idea is awfully common these days among otherwise rational adults. With this notion comes a cruel corollary. Bad stuff happens to you because you have the wrong attitude. If you don't have money, if you don't have health, if you don't have satisfaction in your career, it's because you didn't want it enough. And as somebody who lost a spouse to breast cancer, I could tell you a few stories about the way that belief manifests itself when I talk to people. The small disappointments that started for me with that rock have made me a skeptic, not only towards this kind of magical thinking, but also toward my own wishes. Don't get me wrong, I never stopped wishing, and I don't see much point to a life free of desire, which is one thing I hear some people aspiring to. But I did start questioning my wishes.
I'm Jenny Schultz, and I'm going to talk today, as you already heard, about my five smooth stones. The first book of Samuel in the Old Testament tells how David, a young shepherd, defeats Goliath with only a slingshot and five smooth stones. After hearing a sermon relating to the story of David and Goliath, to the tenets of Universal Unitarianism, I gave some thought to the way these strengths and our James Reeb congregation support my spiritual growth. I'm going to speak brief poems written for these five strengths: community, covenant, revelation, hope, and doing good. Community. A mesh of faithful neighbors serves to start the way to live through interdependency, that trade of loving kindness, heart to heart. The way it works brings many joys to me. Our Sunday greeting calls it radical to welcome people different from ourselves. It's this bouquet of others makes me full of gratitude. I'm happier to dwell amidst a place where some are not like me, where marches and petitions spring to life, brave actions call for peace and equity. These voices and ideas feed my mind. This mixed-up body of believers best affords me focus in my spiritual quest. Covenant. A covenant's a promise, sometimes written, sometimes not. It can be quite official, like a mortgage or a lease. But then one may spring forth from vision, clear as crystal. I hear that's how James Reeb Church began. There was no UU congregation here before the First Society made plans to grow the work of justice and to share beliefs in dignity, compassion, human worth. I gave a promise, signing on the roll, to show support for oh such noble work that tries to bring a better life to all. Our covenant's a challenge and a frame for striving by the light of chalice flame. Revelation. A revelation opens minds to new, exciting visions, stories seen as myth. Bill Moyer's Joseph Campbell interviews on 1980s TV left me with a lesson in the wide world's ancient ways of spirit lore. So many variations woven of the local day-to-day. Each culture was a story of creation. I treasure, too, the scientific way, where minds agree that math can tell Earth's age. I love to think of wondrous distant stars, to think we maybe rode in on a blazar. Both myth and science beckon me to see. My life's a journey of discovery. Hope. It carries me into the unknown place where new experience smacks me in the face. Some facts and outlooks I don't want to know, although without them I would never grow. When stress and anger make my temper hot and bile puts my stomach in a knot, it's difficult to find a peaceful place for reason calm to show its simple grace. On Sundays I light candles, joy or care. The chalice flame at James Reeb holds my prayer. In faith uncertain till my spirit, still my spirit yearns for just a bit of solace on the journey. It's hope that calls me to the UU principles, makes vision of more than of a more than just world more believable. And finally, doing good. It's radical, it's personal, it's fundamental, universal, seeks a time when every curse will be lifted from our wide blue earth. Its marches, signs, its smart designs to make our real estate a place of sanctuary, a stand of people who don't bury our eyeballs in the sand, but see and speak and act for kindness and justice, face the fact of privilege, the differences that skin and country heritage have made to safety, hungry, education, can take one down the road to jail and make another so upscale the true world can't be seen from there. We Reebers try to make things fair, to help the person waiting trial, to challenge muffled-eared denial that too many guns cost too many lives. We try to live life ecological. We carpool, walk, many bicycle. Kids plant seeds in sunny squares behind the church. We buy Just Bakery for our larders, and some share the lemon cukes from their own yard. This purple-painted James Reeb home keeps good work rolling on and on. Broad love and caring never stop on Johnson near the sandwich shop.
So as some of you may have noticed by my piano performance this morning, I have pretty bad anxiety. Intrusive thoughts, man, they're a thing. I've got, you know, a therapist and drugs and everything. And lately, you know, probably for a number of reasons, a lot of which a lot of you can probably relate to, the last while has been quite rough on that, and I'm finding I have tons of difficulty imagining anything in the future other than doom. It's like next Tuesday, doom. So I've never been much of a believer. I really liked the, I'm really more religious than spiritual. This whole coming and doing things with people is good generally, but spirituality, I'm not quite sure about that. Like in my brain, in my psyche, faith and belief are words that are sort of implicitly coded as negatives, sort of associated with like weak irrationality. But I've been trying to challenge that standpoint lately, not only because I find that that's quite insulting to a number of people I quite like, but I've also noticed that it's there in myself. I've noticed that our first UU principle, the one about inherent worth and dignity of all human beings, I really believe in that one. And it's not something that I can formalize into an actual discrete proof. If I try to systematically break down that question of human value, anything that I end up with is something that I know I can't agree with, something that's like straight out of the worst objectivist capitalist philosophy. But I know that my brain is not the best one out there. It's got this ingrained predisposition to pessimism, and anything that I create out of logic is also probably influenced from all of the bits and bobs of society, culture, and education that I've stewed in. And as a side note, I studied industrial engineering, which included homework problems about selecting the best plastic for a part in order to maximize profit over a number of years, including the consideration that that plastic breaks down at the right point to drive up repeat sales. So I've stewed a lot of the capitalist philosophy. But anyways, if there's an ironclad logical argument for the inherent worth and dignity of all human beings, I don't have it. And so, because the world I want to live in is one where we take care of each other, the one where those of us that can pick up for those of us who cannot, a world where people have the freedom and ability to realize their potential, and thrive. I take this statement about inherent worth and dignity wholly on faith, and I kind of have to, because I also realize that if worth is measured by a productive output, by a measurable outcome, opposed to cost, then weighing the thousands of dollars a month in medication that it takes to keep me sustained against whatever meager output I can possibly have just leads nowhere good. And so I take this thing about inherent worth and dignity pretty seriously, but entirely on faith. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the works of Terry Pratchett and Discworld. He wrote a long series of comedic fantasy books where he's got this particular morality and worldview writ large against a background of mostly puns and magic. And I like them, though it is a bit odd that I'm so invested in this series of books where some of the main storylines are about cops and a capitalist dictatorship gets shown in a pretty good light. But I swear the core of the morality of this series is quite good. One of the ongoing themes of Discworld is about the power of belief, that things are how people believe them to be. Think clapping to keep Tinkerbell alive in the musical of Peter Pan, if y'all are familiar about that. Anyways, one book in the series where that theme is closely examined is The Hogfather, which is sort of about the Discworld's equivalent of Santa Claus and Christmas. And there's a bit in that book that I have found knocking around in my head, sort of challenging my brain and just sinking in there. So I'm going to share that bit with you. But I will say Terry Pratchett is really hard to quote. He tends to build things up so that like any impactful moments are really hard to tear out of their context, but I'm going to try. The most context I can probably give you is that something in this story has happened to the Hogfather, aka Santa Claus, and all the unattached residual belief floating around in the world has caused wacky hijinks, and the characters that have found themselves best able to sort this all out are Death and his granddaughter, Susan. Okay. All right, said Susan. I'm not stupid. You're saying humans need fantasies to make life bearable. Really? As if it were some kind of pink pill. No. Humans need fantasy to be human. To be the place where the falling angel meets the rising ape. Tooth fairies. Hogfathers. Little... Yes. As practice. You have to start out learning the little lies. So we can believe the big ones. Yes, justice, mercy, duty, that sort of thing. They're not the same at all. You think so? Then take the universe and grind it down to the finest powder and sieve it through the finest sieve and then show me one atom of justice, one molecule of mercy. And yet you act as if there is some ideal order in the world. As if there is some rightness in the universe by which it may be judged. Yes, but people have got to believe that, or what's the point? My point exactly. It's a bit of an odd statement that fantasy is the practicing grounds for believing that there's some good and rightness in the world. But I think that for where I am right now in this world, with my anxiety and everything else, it's been helpful for that to frame things for me. Maybe not tooth fairies and hogfathers, but if I'm having trouble believing in the big things, like inherent worth and dignity of human beings, or justice, or mercy, or a better tomorrow, then practicing belief in the little fantasies, like my garden, or the sweater that I'm making, where that fun can still be had, and beauty still exists, maybe practicing those will help me get there. And maybe indulging in the whimsical fantasies of Discworld or Wishes and other tales can help me get there even more. And maybe if enough of us believe in the inherent worth and dignity of all human beings, in justice, in mercy, in a better tomorrow, maybe if we clap loud enough, then Tinkerbell will come back to life. So that's where I'm at. I think that counts as spiritual growth, or at least it's trying to. Thanks.
My name's Brian McNerlin. What a diverse collection of readings we've had today. Sure. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. When I leave for work on my bike, it's not yet dawn. As I make my way around the southern shore of Lake Monona, I might see the shadows of a fishing boat in the morning fog. By the time I reach John Nolan Drive, the sun's rays are peeking through the treetops and illuminating the glassy surface. I take it slow along this stretch, listening for the splash of a carp or the sign of a muskrat on the shore. A mallard couple paddle along the rocky shoreline. If the sky is a clear blue, then the lake seems to match it, Some days when a storm's brewing, the water roils a dark purple. Its palette of colors seem infinite. For the next 10 minutes, I make my way northwest along the path. I practice connecting with the lake, allowing its rhythm, its scents, to fill my lungs and my ears. Some days I'll even close my eyes for the briefest of moments as I'm riding my bike to feel everything just a little more intensely. This is a new practice because I'd become complacent in this ride, losing sight of the lake, falling into a somewhat hypnotic state of work-related thoughts. But starting this spring, I've tried to be a little more intentional in my relationship with the lake, to see this precious alone time as a spiritual opportunity to connect with the ancient giant, this thing that's always present, always there for a moment of quiet contemplation. In the State Journal last week, there was a photo series on the lakes, Monona and her sisters, Mendota, Wabisa, and Caganzo. There is certainly a rich history, the many people who've lived, worked, and played around the lakes. These Yahara waters have fostered human development in so many ways. For me, what's important is to see them as more than just a two-dimensional visual artwork that's off to my right as I careen along on two wheels. Instead, I want to feel it deeply to let it nurture my soul. On one ride not long ago, a thunderstorm I thought I could outrun ended up soaking me to the bone. The smaller trees along the shore were bent over. Debris flew into my eyes. The wind nearly knocked me off my bike, and I felt like half the lake had been poured over my head. But when I got to my office, I felt this huge sense of accomplishment, as though I'd been seriously tested and I passed. Nature can be a beast. Anthony McCarr, in a piece he wrote for UU World last year titled "Nature Demands Respect," said this: "Nature is not just walks in the woods and the garden flowers. Nature is also hurricanes and earthquakes and wildfires. And when we respect this fact to the point where we feel fear mixed with awe, it's like a tonic to us, meaning that it comes as healing medicine. And thereby, says Thoreau, we are refreshed, or we're brought back to a state that is truer to our humanity. We become more fully human to the degree we respect wildness and recognize it as a vital dimension of our earth home." This practice, this ritual of mine with the lake, it's not all that unique, and it's certainly been an exercise for thousands of years by people on Monona's shores. There's a reason for it, how entangled our spirit is with the water. As we engage with it physically, we may find a sacred connection as well. This is a very simple thing, to see and smell and feel the waters, to allow oneself to find some harmony between the mundane day-to-day and the remarkable, natural, powerful, primeval. For me, it's pushed me to find equilibrium, to shed the complacency that comes from spending too much time on firm ground. It can quiet a sometimes racing mind and bring some wonderment and optimism to a troubled soul.